Yogi Berra, that great American thinker and philosopher, says that when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Now, of course, which way you take it makes all the difference between ending up in Canada or Mexico, the difference between Portland, Oregon and Portland, Maine, the difference between heaven and hell. That's the whole point of James 3 in the New Testament, that everyone comes to a fork in the road called wisdom and has to decide which way to live, to choose the road called devil's wisdom, described in James 3, verses 14 to 16, or to choose the other side of the fork in the road, and that is God's wisdom in James 3, 17 and 18. It explains to us that choosing God's wisdom, God's way to live, is not just an add-on to the rest of life. It is a total way of life and a way of eternal life. It is radically different than earthly wisdom. The wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial, and sincere. So if you become a Christian, if you live God's way, then this is the way that you will be. First on the list is purity. And it's first on the list because it is more important than anything else on the list. If the purity issue is taken care of, the rest pretty much follows. The word pure comes from a Greek word that was a religious word. The ancient Greeks, when they would go to their temple, had the belief that you had to be completely physically clean in order to go into the presence of the gods. And so they would have sometimes a series of baths, and you would wash and you would wash, you would put on clean clothes so that you would be pure in order to step into the presence of the Greek deity. It's kind of hard to think of quite what is comparable to that in our society. The closest I can think of is the requirement of taking off your shoes for the parade of homes. And you can't quite go in unless you meet the requirement. Or you might think in terms of when you go out to Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, before you go onto any of the concourses, first you have to go through a metal detector. And the metal detector, set to various levels of sensitivity, can tell if you have a weapon, but also if you have coins or an extra thick belt buckle or jewelry that will set it off, a bracelet, maybe even a watch. And they'll send you back. And you have to take it off, set it aside. And then you try again and try again. You've been there. Maybe it's happened to you, or you've watched other people. You wondered how long the line would get. You wondered if the person there would totally disrobe before that person would be allowed to go out into the concourse. And it's for everyone. It's not just the occasional visitor. It's also the frequent flyer. It's also members of the flight crew. You have to be sure that everyone is okay, that everyone meets the requirements before they can be allowed into that secure area of the airport. And the same thing goes for God. Except it's not metal, it's sin. That sin has to be taken care of. It has to be removed before anyone can have access to God. Fascinating how many people pray to God and expect God to quickly and instantly resolve their problems and deal with their issues, but are unwilling to meet the prerequisite of purity. That God expects that every sin be set aside, that we be completely cleaned up before we are privileged to come into his holy presence. There's an irony to it, because the way that we get cleaned up is that God does it. And he does it upon request. He's made an offer, and the offer is that those who will come to him and accept his son, Jesus, as the means of the forgiveness of sin, and this is a big part of it, will acknowledge Jesus as the boss of their lives, that he will then remove every single sin. And the people can then be called Christians and have access to the presence of God. And that if a person sins again, that we then, as Christians, in order to re-access God, must confess our sin. That is, name specifically the sin. Just as we name specifically the keys in our pockets or the coins or the jewelry, so we name the sin that we have committed, whether it be an untruth or an infidelity or a lack of forgiveness or anything else that is short of the purity that God expects and requires. And when we confess that sin and when we resolve to leave it behind and depend upon God to live without it, then we are pure and then we have access to God. And then the other six follow. Next on the list of living God's way is to be peace-loving, which actually means to have right relationships. That the person who is a Christian and is pure, the person who lives God's way, puts enormous value on having right relationships with other people and with God. It may be one of the greatest distinctions between living Christianly and not. Because the earthly wisdom says that it's okay to peg yourself superior to others. It's okay to confront others and damage a relationship. It's okay to offend. It's okay to go to sleep at night filled with anger against someone else. It's, in fact, sometimes advantageous if you keep a vendor at a distance and frightened of you because that vendor knows that you can switch accounts and go to someone else. Or to have employees who have a certain amount of fear and trepidation of the boss because that will make them work harder. There's an earthly wisdom that says that strained relationships can work to your advantage. But heavenly wisdom says that's not true at all. Heavenly wisdom says that right relationships are extremely valuable. That if I offend someone, I need to go to that person and ask that person's forgiveness. That if someone comes to me and asks that I forgive, that I am required to grant that forgiveness. It means that if I'm a Christian, that it's a troublesome thing for me ever to go to sleep at night with the burden of some strain in a relationship with any other person. It means that I'm continually sensitive. I have a love for peace and relationship with other people. That's a heart's desire that comes from God. That I have a right relationship with other people, but also that I have a right relationship with God. That nothing stands between God and me. That I never go to sleep at night without making sure that my relationship with God is what it should be. In fact, it even extends to my concern as a Christian for other people's relationship with God. That I do my part to influence them and help them so that they can be rightly related to me, but they can also be rightly related to God as well. Or add number three to the list. That someone who lives God's way, this person that is pure and peace-loving, is also considerate. You may have another translation of the Bible in English, and if you do, it's a good chance that the word is translated gentle, or maybe kind. That a Christian is a gentle person, a kind person, a considerate person. It is someone who really has no desire to exact the letter of the law. It is the judge that sits on the bench and has every right to come down with the most severe penalty, 20 years in prison, but grants the lighter sentence out of gentleness and consideration. It's the restaurant patron who didn't get the best of service and was kind of irritated by it and decided to set that irritation aside and give the full 15% tip instead of try to get even or try to punish. Give the other person the benefit of the doubt that maybe he or she has had a difficult day or is under some kind of pressure. The considerate Christian always goes the second mile, even though she doesn't have to. She's gentle. When I think of gentleness, I recall a cat that used to be part of our family named Jack. And Jack was this lean and quick family pet that had sharp claws and a fast paw, and could always get whatever he wanted, whether it was me or a bird or whatever his prey might be that particular day. And it was at a time when our children were young, and young children don't always treat cats as cats ought to be treated. So sometimes they would grab too hard or hold upside down or drop unexpectedly or hold close. You don't quite want to hold a cat that wants to move for very long. And you could see what Jack's response would be. He would, when he became irritated, when they had gone far enough, when they'd abused him, he would swing quickly with his paw. And he'd always hit his target, but he never put out his claws. He could have. He could have drawn blood. He could have blinded an eye. But he was a gentle cat. He didn't do what he could have done. Instead, he was considerate. Now, Jack wasn't a Christian, but but Jack was gentle. And Christians are gentle. Christians who live God's way are the kind of people that even if they could bare their claws, even if they could lash out and draw blood, they choose not to because they're considerate and gentle and kind. The Christian who lives by God's heavenly wisdom is also submissive. Literally, that means open to reason or easily persuaded. And it sounds a lot like it's saying that Christians are wimps. The Christians are the kinds of people who submit to other people no matter what they want. So they always surrender in arguments. They always go along with other people. They're always easily pressured and persuaded. But that's really not what it's saying. It's not describing gullibility. It's not talking about the compromise of some essential value or principle or truth. It is saying that this is the person who gives a first inclination to agree with somebody. You know, there's some people who assume that their answer is no, regardless of what your question is. There's some people that are always on the defensive. They're always argumentative. They always disagree. They never want to follow. They never want to go along. But the Christian is different from that. Submissive. My mother had an interesting principle of child raising. She decided with her four children that she would always say yes whenever she could, whenever she was asked. She said that as a parent, there are so many times when you have to say no, that if in doubt, she'd go along. If in doubt, she'd agree. If in doubt, she would say yes. That didn't always come through clearly to me as a child. But I like the principle because I think it's a Christian principle. That people want to be submissive. That they want to understand the other person's point of view and if at all possible, want to go along with it. There's a tactic that is used sometimes in conflict resolution. It is sometimes used in marriage counseling. You may have seen it. You may have done it. It is to bring the two parties that are in conflict together into a room with a counselor, an arbitrator, to sit them down. And the first person is given ample opportunity to present her whole perspective on whatever is the issue. So she explains everything. She can cite examples. She can talk as long as she wants. And then the second person, he can do the same. And he can tell his whole side of the deal and why the conflict is taking place. And then the counselor says, all right, get up and switch places. Now, you have to explain her point of view. You present the whole conflict from the way she sees it, the way she understands it, and you keep doing it until you get it right. And getting it right is that she is satisfied that you have represented her view correctly. And then, when that's finished, then she has to present your side of the argument. your interpretation of every issue, every conflict, everything that has happened. And she has to say it over and over, and it takes a dozen times or 100 times until he is satisfied that she understands and that she has represented his point of view adequately and correctly. And sometimes it takes a dozen tries. Sometimes it never works. That's because some people are totally unwilling to listen to any point of view except their own. But the way of godly wisdom is automatically submissive. It doesn't mean it will go along with anything, but it's preference, it's first choice, it's initial default is to try to say yes, to hear the other person out, to go along whenever possible. Fifth on the list is a pair of characteristics, and they must be put together. This is a 7-point list, not an 8-point list, because number 5 has 2 parts to it, full of mercy and good fruit. Full of mercy refers to love and compassion for people in need. It's sometimes called pity, sometimes called feeling sorry for someone. And especially from a Christian point of view, it is not concerned about how the person got into that situation. That is distinctively different from the non-Christian perspective. For the non-Christian will say, oh, well, a tornado wrecked that person's house. Oh, that person was a victim of a drive-by shooting. Oh, that person got laid off because the company was mismanaged. Anybody can have pity and compassion and be full of mercy for people who get a tough deal in life. But the Christian is full of mercy even for people that brought their maladies upon themselves. And the reason that Christians are that way is because we know that God has had mercy on us and that we have brought our sins and our problems upon ourselves. And so we have the same compassion toward others as God has toward us. But mercy without action really doesn't make any difference. And that's why good fruit is attached. That being full of mercy and doing something about it always are to be combined. That we need to do good for hurting people, those upon whom we have pity. So it's not just saying there are people who are going hungry, but it is giving food to the food shelf or directly to help those people. It's not just saying my heart goes out to those folk down the street and all the problems that they've got. It's calling or knocking at the door and saying, how can I help? It's doing something that produces the good fruit that responds to the heart that is full of mercy. Next, and next to last on the list, is a description that is particularly important to us today. And that is to be impartial. To be impartial is to be without prejudice. Because partiality and prejudice judge people in advance before ever really knowing those people as individuals. And so it is simply not Christian to relate to a person primarily on the basis of race or gender or age or weight or wealth or disability or position or power, or ethnic origin. To do so is to demean that person. And the reason we do it is because that makes us feel better about ourselves. We elevate ourselves by saying, that person is in a different grouping than I am in, and my group is better than that group. No one was better at impartiality than Jesus. He lived at a time when prejudice was very high, almost as great as it is in our country today. He dealt with people who were in groups that were severely discriminated against. Samaritans. They were called half-breeds because they were an ethnically mixed people. Tax collectors. Jesus' kind of people generally hated tax collectors because they were Jews who accommodated the occupying Roman army by collecting the taxes to pay for that army to keep the Jews subjugated. There was discrimination against women. They were not allowed to testify in court. They were not allowed to own property. They really had no standing or status in society. Nor did children. Nor did Gentiles. In fact, if you weren't the right kind of Jewish male, you really were pretty much on the outs. But Jesus, he spoke to Samaritans. He included women among his friends. He was kind to prostitutes. Tax collectors were in his circle of disciples. In some cases, they were people who had no choice about the group in which they were put. They were born into it. They did not determine their gender or their age or their ethnicity. But in some cases, they chose. They chose prostitution. They chose to be tax collectors. But it didn't matter to Jesus how they got to where they were. He was impartial. He did not prejudge them. I'm convinced that in America in 1994, as part of our generation, we are moving into an era of the subclassification of people into every possible different group and the vehemence and the hostility toward people who are in groups that are different from us is escalating to levels that will far exceed the worst that we have in our history. We're sinners, and we like to put people into categories so we have an excuse to treat them poorly. But that is not wise, and that is not Christian, and that is not like Jesus Christ. And so the Christian who lives God's way is impartial. And then last on heaven's list is sincere. Or another way of saying it is without hypocrisy. It was also the Greeks who gave us the word hypocrite, and it originally was a name for an actor. An actor was someone who walked on a stage and took on an identity that was not his. He pretended to be someone else. And that's okay on the stage. But when someone is an actor, a hypocrite in everyday relationships and everyday life, then that's wrong. It's an easy game to play in sincerity. We like to make ourselves look better than we are, to show off, to come across as better than others. Oh, it's not to say that the sincere Christian puts herself down. That's not it at all. It's not that he feigns a false humility. It's mostly a matter of integrity, of honesty, of presenting ourselves for who we really are. Now, as a final example in the last line of James 3, it's a proverb, actually. A proverb that closes this grand description of the person who lives God's way. And it says that peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness. You know what that's communicating? That people who are into doing it God's way, living God's way, people who are peacemakers, who not only love peace but bring together good and right relationships, they are like those who sow seed that eventually in a harvest will burst forth in a harvest of righteousness or things that are really good. Well, it might take a while, but God promises that those who live the right way will see a rich harvest of righteousness. The mother-in-law of a friend of mine came to visit from Chicago. She drove up through Wisconsin, the 400 miles or so between Chicago and St. Paul, alone. Arrived, spent a good week at the home of her daughter and son-in-law and grandchildren. And when the week's visit was up, she went out to the car. They kissed goodbye in the driveway. She got in the car and left. Got onto Interstate 94, and drove and had a good long journey. It was great. There was plenty of traffic, but not too much. The road was smooth. The weather was good. She drove and she drove and she drove. It was pretty easy. It was when she arrived in Fargo that she sensed that something was wrong. It was the sign that she had crossed the border into North Dakota that was the hint that she had gone the wrong way. So she went to the next clover leaf, turned around, drove all the way back, arrived right around dark at their home north of St. Paul, pulled into the driveway, stayed overnight, and then left the next morning and drove to Chicago. It worked out okay, but it's a far more serious mistake when people take the fork in the road that is called earthly wisdom instead of heavenly wisdom. Well, I know there are many people who don't even pay any attention to the signs. It just seems like a lot of people are going that way, so they go that way. And they drive and they drive, they live and they live, and it's kind of easy. Oh, there's bumps and potholes along the way, but there are folks who go almost a lifetime before they realize that they're almost to the entirely wrong and opposite direction. And that's a tragedy. And so it is time for those of us that have gone the wrong way, live by earthly wisdom, to read the signs, to check the compass, to get off, to turn around, to go back, to not make the tragic mistake, but to be a Christian, to live God's way, to be pure, peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial, and sincere.
Our focus guest this morning is John Bonsack, and John is the director of Community Emergency Service, which is in the Philippi neighborhood in the heart of Minneapolis. And our current food drive program will donate much of our food to CES, but they have a lot of other ministry taking place. And Pastor John, as he is known there, is going to give us an update of the work of CES. Thanks.
Thank you, Pastor Joel, and a special, special thank you to each and every one of you here at Wooddale Church. We thank you for your partnership in food, in volunteers, in funds, and in prayer. We would not be able to continue the work in the inner city without each of those components. You have sent thousands of pounds of food. You send many volunteers, including board members, interviewers, office helpers, and prayer partners. And I see Norm Schmitz, one of our faithful volunteers, here in the gathered congregation this morning. We couldn't survive without supplementary and volunteer interviewers such as Norm, because we interview from 8,000 to 10,000 individuals or families per year with food crisis situations, housing crisis, utility shutoffs, and emergency transportation needs. All of these things are done in the name of Christ, and we're able to do that by a personal interview format. That allows us an evangelism opportunity as we talk to folks about their crisis needs. And as a result, many have come to Christ or returned to faith after having backslidden as they have encountered witness in the interview related to their emergency need. Community Emergency Service is founded on John 3:16, God so loved that he gave. But in addition, we also focus on 1 John 3:16. 1 John 3:16 through 18, let me remind you, says this: by this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or speech, but in deed and truth. Community Emergency Service attempts to point beyond bread to the bread of life, beyond ourselves to Jesus Christ. An example would be a prostitute who was chatting with her son one evening, the son about 5 or 6 years old, and he said, "Mommy, why do you have all those bruise marks on your arms?" That set her to thinking. And she decided that even though the pimp had all the funds, she had nothing with which to make a fresh start. She came to Community Emergency Service and said, "Will you help me with rent money so that I can get a fresh start?" As a matter of the witness of CES staff and volunteers, not only did she get rent money, but she got the gospel. She has given her life to Christ and become involved in a church. She, over the course of some months, has married a childhood school friend, and even this summer attended a Bible camp for one weekend, all because folks like you care and share. Now, I want to close with just this observation relative to a Sunday school class. It could have been a church like Wooddale. In any case, this adult and children's education hour was going on that Sunday morning. The teacher had faithfully prepared her lesson plans. She went over it just before class, and as the children came in, she was so pleased to meet and greet them. And then one new child arrived in the classroom, one she'd never seen before. That child had an empty sleeve. One arm was missing, and she quickly thought, is there anything in my lesson plan that might be offensive, any difficulty? No, she thought. And she proceeded with the lesson plan. Things went very well. In fact, they went so well that she finished her lesson early that day and started to think, now what can I do to fill some time? And then she thought, we can do some finger games. And she said, now children, let's remember the old thing about see the church, see the steeple, open the doors and see all the people. She had just announced that. And she realized with that sinking, sick feeling, oh no. But she was saved by a little girl who moved, saved from embarrassment, by a little girl who moved next to the boy. And she said, holding out her hand so that each could use one hand of theirs, she said, let's build the church together. You see, CES, as it were, has one sleeve empty. We don't have all that we need to fulfill the ministry. And so, by God's grace, you have come forward, and through your food, your volunteers, your funds, and your prayers, you have said effectively, let's build the church together. We thank you, and we thank the Lord. I'll be out in the reception area if there are those of you who might have further questions later. God bless you, and thank you.
They don't understand that their materialism is inhibiting their growth. They're trying so desperately to enhance their lives that they're drowning in their own pleasures. There is no joy in their souls anymore.
I wish there was some way I could help them.
I want you to go down there, to talk to them. Help them to find what they think they're seeking in their medications.
You mean meditations?
No, medications. They seem to be placing enormous value on rituals of medication, which they claim will prolong their life. I'd like you to check it out. I'll need a full report by tomorrow.
I'll leave immediately.
Oh, and shut the gate behind you.
Good morning. Can I help you?
I need some blood pressure medication.
I'm sorry, we don't sell prescription drugs here.
I should have known. Oh, she told me to come here. She knew perfectly well I'd be wasting my time.
I'm sorry, who told you to come in here?
Well, my best friend, Laura. She's the reason my blood pressure is so high.
Well, what does she do that makes you so upset?
Everything. She does everything better than me. She looks better than me. She has a better job. She's smarter, nicer, happier, and healthier than me.
Why does that make you so angry?
Because everything in my life is totally out of control. Why should she have tranquility when all I have is chaos?
I think that what your friend has found is that being at peace with God has brought her peace in her own life.
You know, she's so weird to be around. The whole room is in this peaceful state. You'd think she was Mother Teresa for crying out loud. It's like she knows something. The whole room gets in this calmness.
Well, I think you reap what you sow. How considerate are you towards others, for example? Do you show favoritism to some people? Are you sincere in your conversations? Can you honestly say, today, I did the right things. I made the right decisions. I honored my ethics and values.
I can't remember the last day I could say that.
You need to be at peace within yourself first. What are your motives? If they're pure and kind, then I think peace will just naturally blossom. Here.
What's this?
It's a chia pet. You water it daily, and voila, you have sprouts.
What has that got to do with anything?
You've got to start someplace. Start planting the seeds of hope in your life. Those seeds can grow as fast as that chia. There's nothing like it. Just keep watering it and nurturing it, and maybe some of that growth will inspire you.
I don't know. I'll give it a try.
Good luck. Oh, my heavens. Is it that late already? I've simply got to fly. Remember, it likes lots of water and sunshine, and practice nurturing a peaceful environment.
Bye. Can't wait to show Laura.